This recording was made at a public hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on Thursday, January 26th. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Why don't we reconvene the special session of the Federal Election Commission. Please come to order. This afternoon, we are going to hear from our sixth and final panel, last but definitely not least, in terms of the Commission's reconsideration of the agency's coordination regulations. The panel will last for 1.5 hours, as our earlier panels have, and each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. The green light at the witness table will start to flash when the person speaking has 1 minute remaining, and the yellow light will go on when the speaker has 30 seconds left, and the red light means it's time to wrap up your remarks. We'll have at least one round of questioners from the commissioners and the general counsel, as well as our acting staff director, and we've had sufficient time in our earlier panels to have a second round of questions, which I'm sure will be a delight for everybody. Our panel this afternoon consists of Peggy McCormick, who's appearing on behalf of the National Education Association, Donald McGann on behalf of the National Republican Congressional Committee, and Lawrence Noble on behalf of the Center for Responsive Politics. We typically go in alphabetical order in terms of opening statements, so that would mean that we would begin with you, Ms. McCormick, followed by Mr. McGann, and then Mr. Noble. So, Ms. McCormick, whenever you're ready to begin.
Okay, I think I can probably begin now. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I appreciate this opportunity to appear before you on behalf of the National Education Association, a labor organization with more than 2.7 million members who are employed in the field of public education. What I'd like to do is to focus my testimony today, because I know you've heard from my colleagues, Larry Gold and Mike Trister, who shared in the comments that we submitted, on the conduct standards and the proposed changes that we had suggested to those. I'd like to start by saying that I think what we would like to urge the Commission to do is to change the current conduct standards in three ways. First, we'd like you to eliminate the common vendor and former employee prong of the conduct standards. We want to ask you to do that, or we ask you to do that for several reasons. One is we don't believe there's any empirical support for having that as a conduct standard. There's no showing that I know of or that I could find, nor do I think the Commission has held hearings to find such evidence that actually there is actual coordination occurring through the use of common vendors or former employees. Not only is there no particular reason for having this rule in terms of evasion of the act, but I also think it's important to get on the record that this is a very burdensome rule for organizations such as NEA and other organizations that commonly use political consultants in their campaign process. The way the rule works now is that in order to avoid the risk of taking an FEC complaint and the possibility of a subsequent investigation, not that we will have done anything wrong, but because investigations by the Commission are enormously burdensome for the organization and intrusive, in order for that to happen, my client and many other organizations are unwilling to employ anyone as a vendor, as a political consultant, who during the entire election cycle has worked for a candidate, a federal candidate, or for a political party. Now, the election cycle is very long, and the number of top-flight political consultants, especially those who sort of share the general views of my client, is very small. So our experience was in the 2004 cycle, it took us weeks, sometimes months, to be able to hire a political consultant. Why? Because the minute the name was brought up, we had to contact that person. We had to ask them, all right, tell us every one of your clients from the beginning of the election cycle until now. Also tell us who you think you might want to work for the rest of the election cycle. And it went on and on and on. so that by the time we would be able to find a consultant, we ended up having to rule out people that had been used by the organization in completely non-electoral context because they wanted to preserve their right to work for either a candidate or a party. People were unwilling to say, we'll take your work. I mean, we can't offer them a contract that covers all of their expenses and generates all of the income that they need. But at the same time, we were saying to them, as we use you, you can't take work from a political party or a federal candidate. And it became extremely burdensome to do. As a fallback, if the commission chooses not to simply eliminate common vendors, and I do think my colleague Mike was talking about using the agency rules, which I think are one answer. If you choose not to do that, then I think as a fallback, we would ask at least that you try and narrow the rule to make it a little bit more realistic and to avoid interfering with organizations' abilities to use consultants. And also, I think, if you called in Peter Hart and Jeff Guerin and a bunch of consultants, they would tell you this is interfering with their work as well. It's not just us. And I think the changes we'd ask you to make is, one, remove the use standard, because we think that that is extremely chilling. It requires a consultant to have to prove a negative. In fact, they have to prove that somehow in their mind they didn't do something, which I would find to be a very difficult burden of proof, and I think they would feel the same way. And second, to reduce the amount of time, the time period in which someone would be considered to be a common vendor. In other words, if they had worked, for a candidate or a party committee 120 days ago, maybe they're within the time frame, but if they worked for them from the beginning of the cycle until up to the 120 days, they would not be treated as a common vendor. I think those two changes would be very helpful, and they would address a real need in the regulated community to be able to use the services of consultants, and a real need for consultants to be able to get work. So it would help all of us. The second thing I wanted to talk about today is the idea of establishing a firewall as part of the conduct provisions. Now, I know my colleagues have talked to you about the idea of having a safe harbor as part of the content provisions for lobbying activity, but I believe that that is not enough to protect organizations that lobby for the following reasons. The safe harbor that would protect lobbying activities would protect an organization that lobbies and then talks to office holders about it and goes out and continues to do lobbying communications. What it doesn't help with is an organization that lobbies and also engages in covered electoral communications. In other words, if you go up on the Hill and you talk to Senator Kennedy about a bill that he is working on with your organization, and subsequently down the line, 6 months later, you run an independent expenditure in which you name Senator Kennedy and urge people to vote for him, your initial meeting with Senator Kennedy creates an opportunity for coordination. And if that meeting is public knowledge, any one of your opponents can file a complaint and say, there was an opportunity during that meeting for you to have talked to Senator Kennedy about his campaign plans. Not that you did it, but the mere fact that during the lobbying you had contact and communication with an incumbent who's also a candidate means that you create an opportunity for coordination, which then creates the risk that somebody's going to file a complaint and say, well, we know you talked to Kennedy on this and this date. We know you ran an independent expenditure on that and that date, so you must have coordinated it.
Ms. McCormick, if you could conclude your remarks, I apologize. Your time has expired.
I'm sorry. So I think that's where I'd like to leave it, actually, is those are the two major changes, and the other change we're going to suggest is that you also create a safe harbor for public communications.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Mr. McGann.
Thank you. Here today on behalf of the NRCC, a national party committee dedicated to electing Republicans to the U.S. House. We have a vital interest in this rulemaking given the amount of independent expenditures that we make, particularly last cycle, in the post-McCain-Feingold hard money world. By way of introduction, I guess the first thing I want to note is, having read the Shays court opinion, the court did not take issue with the reg itself. I'm sure you've heard this a million times already in this hearing, but took issue with the justification, not necessarily justification in and of itself, just didn't have enough justification, perhaps is one way to read it. What's interesting about that is that there's no obligation to have year-round coordination rules or anything of the sort. The court essentially said it's okay to have some kind of time limit as to when coordination matters and when it doesn't. Our view is that this is consistent with the statute itself, but we would suggest that 120 days is not nearly as consistent with the statute as a 30-60 day window, which is found in the electioneering communications section. The 30 day before the primary, 60 day before the general rule makes sense really for two reasons. One, as a practical matter, it is the time when the party committees do spend their money for campaigns and elections. And it would be tailored to address what I think the sponsors of BCRA and what the concern is, and that is evading the contribution limits or evading the coordinated expenditure limits. You don't really see party committees doing year-round independent expenditures. And to the extent that party committees have done issue ads and whatnot, they tend to be just that, issue ads designed to influence legislation, not ads designed to influence the election. But there's more really an important reason that where 30-60 works, and that is the data. I reviewed the numerous spreadsheets that were attached to the proposed rulemaking, and it doesn't take a lot of reading to see that the ads occur within 60 days of the general election. One thing I do note, I noticed some dates that seem to be in June or in January or in February. Just keep in mind there's special elections, and I noticed quite a few elections that were actually special elections, so it's not that those ads were run for the general election that year. It was run for a special election. I saw some data about advertising in probably the 02 cycle, Mike Forbes' election in New York, Randy Forbes' election in Virginia. Those were specials, and that spending was not designed to influence the November election. It was designed to influence the special, and that was still well within 60 days of that election. The thing that struck me about the comments were the comments filed by Senator McCain and the other sponsors of BCRA. They also effectively say some kind of time limit is appropriate. Now, they want to treat different political speakers differently, part political committees one way, outside groups another way, and someone else another way. We don't endorse that view, but the idea that the sponsors, primarily also the people who brought the lawsuit, are not opposed to some kind of time limit, I think, goes a long way towards upholding any sort of time limit. As far as specifics, the NRCC did not do independent expenditures last year until late in the cycle. The notice of the rule mentions a variety of scholarly works and one not-so-scholarly speech given by yours truly. I didn't comment that on my comments because it just kind of would have been awkward to say the NRCC thought it was brilliant. But I was truthful then, I'm truthful now. The hot spot in the campaign was mid-September to late September, and we see that being the hot spot, at least for the foreseeable future, this cycle and probably from here on out, for no other reason we don't have as much money as we used to have, and we can't stretch the dollars with the overhead ratio and issue ads. That being said, there are some other issues in addition to the TV ads and the so-called sexy stuff. Endorsements is a hot issue, very difficult to deal with because the statute says you can endorse a state or local candidate, but yet is that something of value now to the federal candidate who may endorse a state or local candidate? Because obviously the state or local candidate is going to want to tell someone publicly, and they're probably going to be in that person's district. Frankly, the federal candidate is not receiving anything of benefit in 9,000ths out of a million time, whatever the fraction is that I'm using for dramatic effect. It tends to be safe incumbents endorsing state or local candidates. They're going to win anyway. There's nothing of value, but yet now they have to jump through 50 hoops to try to figure out how to do it. The same is true of television advertisements, mail pieces or whatnot that mention candidates. I'm thinking of the Alice Forgy George Bush AO, which on its face, I think there was problematic language in the request about the White House's wanting to review it for content and style points and all that kind of stuff. It'd be nice if it were made clear that if you don't really want to review it for that sort of thing, but simply because you don't want to be sued for defamation or something because you're in the ad, that would not be considered an in-kind. That candidates can work with each other in ways that are not trying to backdoor soft money in the federal elections. I think that AO goes too far because I think the reg went too far in that respect. Same is true of fundraising. We've had some issues with our fundraising because if you have a member of Congress sign a letter that goes into a particular district that happens to be their district, and it may say, we need to elect Republicans, we need to re-elect the ones we have and the ones who are running, and you sign the letter, well, you're mentioning a candidate because there you are. You're talking about electing Republicans and re-electing Republicans. So all of a sudden you're in a situation where that's something that looks like it may trigger some sort of coordination rule. Common vendors, to pick up on themes raised by others, not only in this panel but in some of the comments, there is a Chinese puzzle, so to speak, with vendors where you have to figure out what vendors can do what. It's very cumbersome. It is what it is, I suppose, but there are some things that I think could be tweaked. To put it in context, we just sent out our request for proposals for our independent expenditures last week. We are how many months before the election, and we are already locking down our vendors to make sure we don't have coordination problems. But there are certain kinds of vendors, like fundraisers, who don't move the kind of information back and forth that we're worried about in the coordination rules, and media placement vendors. I'm not talking about media production companies that also place the buy. I'm talking about people who just place the buy. Media inventory is public. It's public information. They're listed as a vendor that could be a problem under coordination rules. They really are not a problem under coordination rules, nor should they be, which leads me to my final point, publicly available information. There is some confusion on this. I think the DCCC comments hit the mark when they say that there should be some sort of safe harbor for publicly available information. If you summarize publicly available information, the summary shouldn't be deemed some sort of coordination conspiracy, and this could address the media buying issue I've raised because that's public information. And with that, that's my introduction. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGann. Mr. Noble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the Commission, General Counsel, Acting Staff Director. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today on the coordination rulemaking. It looks like we're coming to the end of a long and troubled effort to write rules for a law that's already been in effect for over 3 years. The court rejected the previous attempt to define coordination, saying that the FEC had not adequately justified it. But the court, if you look at what it said, went beyond that and really questioned the justification for 120-day rules, imposing 120 days. Coordination is not just a technical rule. And this is important to keep in mind. This is not just some implementation of a rule that has to do with a technical part of the federal campaign finance laws. Coordination goes to the heart of the federal campaign finance laws because what it does is it defines the line between activity that is subject to a lot less regulation, which is independent activity, and that which the Supreme Court says can be regulated more heavily, contributions. Ever since Buckley, we've been living with this regime where we have to look at the difference between independent expenditures and contributions. Coordination takes what would otherwise be an independent expenditure and brings it in as a contribution. It is no different. Once you coordinate an ad, it is no different than as if you had given the candidate the money, him or herself, to run the ad. And that's why this is so critical. If it's independent activity, then what we're looking at is activity that can only be regulated if it's express advocacy or electioneering communication. If it's coordinated activity, it's going to fall under all the contribution limits and prohibitions. Paying $100,000 for a campaign ad coordinated with a candidate is no different than giving that campaign the $100,000. That's why we think the Commission must adopt regulations that are consistent with the law and the intent of the law. Obviously, there's a tension between impinging on constitutionally protected grassroots lobbying while implementing the restrictions and limitations of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. Keep in mind the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act has been held constitutional, and the government has a compelling interest in stopping real and apparent corruption, and that's what these rules go towards. The FEC's desire to minimize the burden on the regulated community cannot override the agency's mandate to enforce the laws as enacted by Congress. So far, in our view, the FEC's effort to write regulations in the coordination field have ignored an obvious reality. Election campaigns are not magically limited to 100 days before the primary, stop right after the primary, and then pick up again 120 days before a general election. In fact, campaigns don't even just begin 120 days before the primaries. Campaigns are taken out long before 120 days before the primaries, and in some races, and this has been lamented by some, we seem to have a permanent campaign season. Allowing a corporation to or a labor union to coordinate an ad 121 days outside of the primary is no different than saying they can give a contribution 121 days outside the primary. The Court of Appeals in Shays rejected the FEC's earlier rule because it said there was no factual basis for picking the 120-day line. This led the court to a very practical question. Do candidates, and I underscore candidates because that's the word the court used, do candidates in fact limit campaign-related advocacy to the 4 months surrounding elections, or does substantial election-related communication occur outside that window? That is a question that was posed to the commission. I think the answer is obvious. We have provided examples of over 200 campaign-related advocacy ads run outside the FEC's window. Now, let's be very clear. We are not claiming that the ads were coordinated. We have no way to know. We have not investigated the ads. But that's not the relevant question. The question wasn't whether or not coordinated ads are run outside that period, but whether or not campaign ads are run outside. Why? Because if campaign ads are run outside that period, then, in fact, coordination becomes important for those ads. This is why, by the way, in our view, the proposal to limit the rule to 30-60-day rule that some of the commenters have made, I think, would totally fail any test the court wanted to use. I don't think there's any relationship to the law with that test. And keep in mind that it's the electioneering communication standard of 30 and 60 days deals with what is, in effect, an independent ad, not a coordinated ad. We have done something that is somewhat controversial and very dangerous. We proposed actual language for a rule. Knowing full well as we did so that we were laying ourselves out there, but we figure since you guys do it, maybe we should too occasionally. Our rule, we think, is a reasonable attempt to come up with various standards that take into account various organizations, what they do, and try to capture rules that are capture ads that are in fact campaign ads, and bring the coordination rules into play when you use when you do campaign ads. I'll end on this note. Keep in mind that what we're talking about here is not rules that apply to every ad taken out. It has to be a public communication. It has to be directed to the voters in the jurisdiction of the candidate with which the ad is coordinated. And the activity involved must meet the conduct standard of the FEC. If any of those are missing, then you will not look at the rest of the rule. So this is not something where all lobbying campaigns are all of a sudden going to fall under these rules. Yeah, I don't think it can go without notice today that while we're here discussing the ability of corporations, labor unions, and individuals to spend lots of money in coordination with a campaign as a way of influencing that campaign and helping that campaign, Congress down the street is dealing with a lobbying scandal that deals with the influence buying by corporations, lobbyists, and others. It would indeed be ironic if the FEC opened up a new loophole for influence buying, just as Congress is looking at ways to close another loophole. I urge you not to do it, and I urge you to come up with a rule that really does reflect reality and how campaigns are, in fact, run. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. We commented yesterday when would be the first time Jack Abramoff or a reference to his situation would appear in the record, and you are the second person to make that reference. But you came close.
It's only because you put me on last.
If you'd been here yesterday, I think you probably would have achieved that. Ms. McCormick, I'd like to begin with you. Your comments and the joint comments that you and Mr. Gold and Mr. Trister submitted draw upon the safe harbor that the the agency, if I can manage this electronic device, that the agency proposed with respect to alternative four. And there's a number of criteria that are listed in the MPRM, and I understand that your joint comments support that framework with certain modifications to the framework. Could you discuss briefly why you think that would be an appropriate way for the agency to go? It would not involve a time dimension, but instead would be a different cut at it, looking at certain types of communications that, in your view, should be shielded because they are relate to lobbying activities.
I'd be delighted. I think, and I want to echo one of the remarks of one of the commenters yesterday, which is I think that the commission has a very difficult balancing test here. And it's not a test that you don't have in lots of other areas, but definitely in the coordination area. On the one hand, you know, as a graduate of this agency, I think that you have a duty to ensure that the contribution limits of the Act are not evaded. And certainly, as a lawyer, I support that. On the other hand, I think that Congress made quite clear when it enacted BCRA, and the courts have made clear, that there is First Amendment protected activity such as lobbying that should not be regulated by the rules of the commission. So I think what you're looking for is a test which on the one hand will capture a goodly amount, I guess, of content that is election related. I'm not going to say 100% because I don't believe that's the standard, and thereby protect the contribution limits of the Act. And on the other hand, a content standard which is going to allow organizations and individuals, for that matter, to engage in protected issue speech and lobbying and other kinds of public communications that really aren't within the content that this agency should be regulating and to which people have a First Amendment right, the kind of speech they have a First Amendment right to make. So I think if you proceed along a timeline, you back yourself exactly into the position which we've been hearing about for the past 2 days, because no matter where you set the bar, someone is always going to say, well, what about these ads, right? Or this is either too inclusive or it's it's under-inclusive, right? There's always someone that's going to argue that. So what we tried to do when we were thinking about this is to say, well, how could you do it without reference to time and yet still protect the rights of organizations such as ours? I admit that we were being somewhat selfish about it, but we think it includes a lot of organizations out there, to be able to engage in certain protected First Amendment activity, such as lobbying and some other things, and yet at the same time be able to bring in enough content that really is election-related content. And I think we believe that creating the safe harbors that we've suggested would allow the commission to do that, and it would allow you to get out of the time bind.
And Mr. Noble, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, because the criteria that the MPRM talked about and that Ms. McCormick is referring to, it was a number of things, but whether the communication is devoted to a pending legislative or executive branch matter, whether the communication refers to a clearly identified federal candidate's record or position on issues, whether it refers to candidate's character, qualifications, or fitness for office, and whether it refers to an election or voting or anyone's candidacy. And as I understand Ms. McCormick's argument, her view is that an exemption along these lines could be appropriately fashioned that would apply across all time, not just in the last 120 days and not just any other time dimension. Your thoughts on that? Do you think we could appropriately do that?
No, I don't.
Why not?
I think some of those standards can be used at certain time periods, but I think to apply them across the board would exempt a lot of obvious campaign activity, coordinated campaign activity. And again, we have to keep repeating that we're not talking about lobbying ads that are taken out that are not coordinated with a candidate. We're talking about lobbying ads that are taken out that are coordinated with a candidate, where, in fact, often they look exactly like campaign ads. We think, for example, that when you're dealing with a political committee, virtually everything a political committee does is campaign related. The Supreme Court has recognized that, and that's why the Supreme Court has said that you don't need as exact a standard when you're dealing with a political committee. So to apply that type of standard for a political committee coordinating with a candidate to us would make no sense. Even when you're dealing with other organizations, there are a lot of ways, and the court in Shays recognize this, there are a lot of ways that you can run campaign ads coordinating with a candidate that don't mention the candidate or that don't talk necessarily about the candidate's qualifications for office that would still be campaign ads. So I just think that what that would do would just allow a lot of coordinated campaign ads that would that are illegal under BCRA.
Ms. McCormick, any response to that?
Yeah, I think so. I think Larry's view is sort of shaped by what I would think of as kind of a myopic vision of the world, because his view is all about campaign finance. And he views anything that's done as having basically an electoral... I'm sorry, it's not you, your clients, all right?
Actually,
as having an electoral purpose, okay? So he looks at everything that's done as having the purpose of influencing an election. I come from a very different world. In our world, people have other fish to fry. We have lobbying communications to make. We have members to serve. Not everything that we do relates to or has the purpose of influencing a federal or a state or any other election. And so I think the broader you make the standard, the more likely you are to capture perfectly legitimate activity, such as lobbying activity and issue advocacy, that we do has nothing to do with elections.
If I may respond to that, please. And I don't have that myopic view, but we are here talking about the campaign finance laws. We are here talking about the application of the prohibitions and limitations of the campaign finance laws. And the reality is that groups do take out ads that are campaign ads, and they often want to coordinate those ads with the candidates. So to say that doesn't go on, and I know Peggy's not saying that, but to say that doesn't go on, or even to look at it doesn't go on, it's just not recognizing reality. Also, the rules allow lobbying campaigns. What we're talking about are certain types of ads that are coordinated with the candidate and run in the district where that candidate you've coordinated with is running. One of the questions that I think keeps popping up is, if the candidate is supporting you, and you are running that, and you want to run an ad, why would you run the ad in his district to lobby him to support you if he already supported you and you've already coordinated the ad with you? So I think there's a lot of room out there under these proposals for lobbying campaigns. But the reality is, Congress passed the law, the Supreme Court has upheld it, the FEC has to implement it.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Would be more persuaded by your point, Mr. Noble, if the regulations, the coordination regulations, didn't also cover parties, and if some of the candidates were, or some of the legislators weren't also the heads of political party committees. And so I have some concerns, both that political parties are involved in the lobbying process as a factual matter, and that a number of, and the leaders of some of these party committees are also prominent members, the leadership of their, in the legislature. But my question really to you is about a somewhat different problem. As I understand sort of the your concerns with the proposal, I looked a little bit at the 200 ads. You give that number. I'll take you at your word. That fell outside of the 120-day time period. My understanding of your concern is in part that some of those ads fell outside the 120-day time period, and therefore they create the potential for an opportunity for people to coordinate in a way that they shouldn't. But that the remedy really wouldn't be to extend that time period to cover those kinds of ads. That you have a fundamental, that you don't believe that we should simply be adjusting the temporal time period of regulation, but that we should adopt a different regulatory scheme. And I wanted to get a sense of whether that was true. If we looked at all of those ads and found the outer limits of a time period before an election at which these kinds of ads were run and picked that date, would that satisfy the concerns you have, or does our entire temporal approach have a flaw to it?
Well, we also incorporated a temporal approach in ours, but we also added, because of concerns about the type of ads these would reach, we also then added more of a content standard about what the ads actually did. The problem with just having a temporal approach, as the court said in Shays, is yes, you can set the line somewhere, but why? Why 120 days? Why at 200 days? And so you have to really have some justification for doing it. I think you also have to recognize that history has shown that campaigns themselves run ads sometimes a year before. We can go back to the Clinton campaign, and which really started with the DNC actually running ads early on that were that were, in, for all intents and purposes, campaign ads, and they started running them a year in advance. So I think that I think you can have a temporal approach that has to have some other elements to it, and also has to adjust for who the speaker is. And just to go back to your earlier comment about the political parties, I understand what you're saying about the political parties, but as the Supreme Court has said, political parties present the least problem constitutionally, since their very purpose is to elect candidates. I know they do other things, but at the heart of their very purpose is to elect candidates. So there's much less concern about vagueness or overbreath when you get to political parties.
Could you describe for us what your proposal is, the alternative that you're presenting?
Right. What we've done is we've divided into three groups. Political committees, 527 groups, and all other individuals. And I'll say at the outset that the using a separate provision for 527s is part due to the fact that, in our view, they should be considered political. Many of them should be considered political committees, but since they're not, we had to work with the way the commission is presently looking at it. What
if
we're
I could
saying,
interrupt for a second. Now, when you say 527s, do you mean all 527 organizations?
No. We would mean 527s who are involved in federal activity.
And how would we discern that?
Well, now we're getting into the whole question of the 527 issue. What we'd say is any public communication by a 527 which is not registered as some other type of organization, any public communication that is coordinated with the candidate meets the conduct standard. It does not need to refer to a party or political candidate 30 days before the election or 30 days before primary, 60 days before the general would be considered coordinated. So you look at these are 527s who aren't political committees, but they're also not necessarily gubernatorial campaigns. But if a gubernatorial campaign started getting involved in this activity, then yes, you treat them the same.
So when you say that, so if a gubernatorial campaign met with the senator, or say the gubernatorial campaign is the reelection campaign of the sitting governor, and they met with a senator on Medicare reimbursement for the states and wanted to run ads on that issue,
case. In that case, I would say you would not have to apply it in that situation.
And why not? What's missing?
In that situation, if the campaign was just running, well, let me think. I mean, I knew we were going to go through a lot of different hypotheticals. A gubernatorial campaign, they're not mentioning the candidate, correct?
I don't know. The governor hasn't decided yet. I mean, matter if he says the Senator Smith's amendment to the Medicaid bills that would provide additional aid to the states? Does it change the hypothetical then?
If in fact they are mentioning the federal candidate, then yes, I do think you're in a different situation.
Okay. What if they said Republicans are cutting again important health needs for our citizens? You know, we need your help to protect the least advantaged among us. Does it fall within the category?
And they met with federal
the senator.
The senator, and where is the ad shown?
In this governor's state. The senator's state is from the same state. Because the senator is part of the budget committee and budget process in the Hill and the bill-making process on the Hill.
These are the tough hypotheticals. It may very well have to fall under it. I'd have to think about that. It may very well have to fall
under it. So in that case, the governor's meeting with the senator then triggers the coordination rules?
It may very well, depending on what the ad is, yes.
If to the degree that he complains about there being Republican budget cutters.
Well, if it's not mentioning the candidate,
but he's mentioning the party, and the party's going to have candidates.
And the party has a candidate. I'm going to say right up front, there are obvious areas in this where we'd have to figure out the details in the application, as you will in your rule. I mean, there are some areas where it's not. It is. You can go one way or the other on it.
But the problem that we're wrestling with, a number of us up here, is that presumably, assuming the governor has good sense and good counsel, they're going to go and try and sort it out through these, figure out what the regs say.
Right.
And the best sense we have is that it's ambiguous as to whether they could.
Well, I would say let me rephrase my answer then. You can define that one way or the other. I would say you have to be very careful when you're writing the rules to not have a situation where state candidate offices can be used to coordinate with the federal office and help the federal candidate. If you can craft a rule in such a way, and that would then still allow some talking over an issue and an ad to come out. Now, we're talking about 30 days before primary, 60 days before general. Then you may be able to do that. You may be able to craft it. We took a crack at crafting a rule. We recognize in doing this that there are some, leaves open some questions.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I notice my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason. Mr. Noble, I'm going to continue picking on you, but you're used to it.
And I love it.
Not
it's picking.
Picking, no.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't.
Concentrating.
Fair questions.
There's in Mr. McGann's testimony, there's a reference to the buying time study and some related studies and the alleged overbreadth of those, and the you know particular figure that's cited here that I think was in some of the court opinions was 7%. You know, this caught 7% of genuine issue ads. And the argument seemed to be, well, that was okay. It wasn't substantial overbreadth. And, of course, now we're going to have a go-around with Wisconsin Right to Life about how we deal with that 7% or whatever the number is. But my question to you is, how good is good enough for us? Because you come back with some ads that are outside the 120-day time frames, and if we got 93%, would that be good enough?
Well, first of all, the buying time study went to electioneering communications, which was independent activity. And when you're dealing with independent activity...
I understand, but if the answer ultimately is no, that's okay. Tell me how much is good enough.
I don't know how much. How much is good enough? Could you say... I mean, this is a decision you have to make. But I can tell you that that in certain circumstances, I think you have to catch every ad that is coordinated with a campaign, and our rule says that. For example,
okay. Well, let me. All right, then that's okay. I think that's an unrealistic standard, but let's go on. Do you think that candidates should be able to coordinate with their parties regarding generic party advertising? I'm not talking about anything that mentions a Canada. I mean, just vote Republican, vote Democrat. But the issue is, you know, should we talk about corruption in Congress, or should we talk about wiretapping, or should we talk about, you know, stopping terrorists, or, you know, what's the issue that we give people to vote? And let's say you've got a small state, and there's one senator up for election, and three or four representatives, and the party, you know, and gets them all in a room and says... You know, what should the theme be? Should that be okay?
It's okay. The question is, does it come under the coordinated
party
expenditure?
Well, that's my answer. Is it legal?
If they sit down and they work out the ads, then yes, I think I think you have a coordinated expenditure.
So you think a completely generic ad that doesn't mention any of those candidates, but because the candidates have discussed it.
Not just discussed it. I mean, again, you have a conduct standard. It's not just that they know the ads are being run. They have to have material discussion about the ads.
Yes, they have a debate. They have a debate about what's the theme.
Yes,
and they vote on it, or you know, come to a consensus on it. In your opinion, I'm just not aware that the commission has ever taken that position before. That a candidate's involvement with a party's generic ad turned the generic ad into a contribution to the candidate.
No, actually, previously, in recent years, the commission has gone the exact opposite direction.
But you're suggesting that we ought to do that.
Again, I'm realistic about this. You're not going to go. I'm putting in front what we think you should do. Yes, but my answer is yes, you should do that.
Let me ask one final thing. You understand that a convention that has authority to nominate a candidate is an election.
Right.
And that triggers the 120-day period
right.
Under these rules. So why does your submission have 154 pages of general election candidate ads in Roman number 4 that all fall within 120 days of the National Party conventions or of a primary?
Well, because the question that was asked was a primary or a general election.
But all of these ads in your submission are covered in the time period of our current regulation. Because the ones in the summer, the ones in June and July, were within 120 days of the National Party nominating convention. And the ones in February were in 120 days of a primary. And yet you've got 154 pages of them in here that you're citing as one of the reasons we need to go out and regulate more. And in terms of the time period, they're already covered.
So you're saying that the 30 days before primary and 60 days
120
before,
right now.
Or, well, 120 days before primary, you're counting 120 days from the convention.
Well, I mean, the rule says You know, first it comes from the definition of election, but it says 120 days before a general, special, or runoff election, or 120 days before a primary or preference election, or a convention or caucus of a political party that has authority to nominate.
And we focused
a candidate.
On, I'd have a look at the ads again, we focused on the primaries and generals. But again, I don't think it fundamentally undercuts the point that these ads do come out before the 120 days. We have many ads there that are outside that period.
If we're not being held to 100% standard, and I understand that's not your position, it takes out 154 pages. You know, of this submission, and it gets to the issue of how much of this goes on and how much would be is excluded under the current rule versus how much is included.
Well, but you would have to concede then, even under your position, that the period between the 120 days of the primary, between the end of the primary and the beginning of the general, there's definitely campaign ads that come out.
For a presidential election, there was no gap in the last cycle.
I'm not talking just for presidential. I'm talking about congressional elections.
Yes, but there don't seem to be any ads there. I'm talking about the volume of ads. I mean, yes, if you've got some ads that fell in a gap in Illinois where they have a March primary, fine. You know, I mean, I think that's a fair point, but I'm asking about these. And what you're saying is you agree that 154 pages is irrelevant.
I have to go back and look at the dates. I trust you on what you're saying about the dates on them. I'll have to go back and look on the dates. But it still doesn't affect... I mean, it still doesn't affect the main point that these ads are run even 120 days before the conventions. I mean, I don't know how, and we can provide more ads. I don't know how one could look at probably any election of my lifetime and say that campaign ads are not run 120 days before an election. Candidates don't run ads 120 days before election. Look at the commission's own investigation and audit of the 96 campaign. Ads were taken out a year and two years in advance.
The court question was, how much does this happen? And that's one of the things we're charged with looking for. And in response to the question of how much, you gave us 154 pages of ads that don't fall outside the time period.
Now, I will go back and check that. But I also say then, could the commission say that, well, since most contributions are made within 30 days or 60 days or 120 days of an election, we can exempt money going to a campaign more than 120 days before an election.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Weintraub.
I would just point out the obvious, that money going to a campaign is never going to be a lobbying communication that somebody might want to protect under the First Amendment. It's just not the same thing. You're comparing apples and oranges.
Well, actually, no, the Supreme Court has said they're exactly the same thing. Coordinated expenditures are exactly the same as contributions.
That's not what I said.
That's not what she said.
I'm talking about the lobby, the kind of grassroots lobbying communications that Ms. McCormick is trying to protect, that I think even the Supreme Court would admit there's a First Amendment interest in protecting. At least that's what I heard Justice Breyer saying very recently. And what I'm telling you is that interest is not that making a cash contribution to somebody, writing out a check, does not convey the same sort of message that a lobbying communication to a member of Congress does. It's just you're not talking about the same things. Yes, they are both in some sense covered by the campaign finance regime, but it doesn't mean they're the same thing. Let me see if I could get agreement on something. I'm hopeful that maybe there is at least one little thing. We talked a lot about endorsements in the course of these 2 days, and there's a lot of interest in our crafting an exemption for endorsements of federal candidates, of state candidates, and I suppose in some context federal candidates of other federal candidates, based on the two AOs that we've issued. And and believe it or not, we actually are concerned about not promoting circumvention of the law, so we've been trying to figure out how we would go about crafting this kind of an exemption. And one possibility is that we could say endorsements don't count as long as they don't promote or support the endorsing federal candidate. I would ask all three of you whether you think that would be a permissible and useful provision to write into the into the regulations.
As long as they don't promote support.
Yeah, I assume that if you're endorsing somebody, it's not going to attack or oppose the person who's making the endorsement.
But what about the person doing the maybe I'm not understanding the hypothetical. The
federal candidate endorses state candidate. State
right.
candidate wants to run an ad showing
right.
the federal candidate endorsing the state candidate.
Right.
As long as that ad does not promote or support the federal candidate, would that be okay?
Yes. I could understand what that means.
You understand what that means? Thank you.
I understand what that
means.
If you're doing, if you're trying to backdoor your own advocacy for your campaign, can't do that. If it's I endorse this person and there you are, that's fine.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. That seems to be what the statute was trying to say when it said you were allowed to endorse.
Ms. McCormick, that work for you?
I agree. It's not something that comes up for us, but I think it makes sense. Yes.
Mr. Noble.
I'll abstain.
Oh, come on.
But what's the problem with that? The statute says you can endorse, right?
Yeah.
Endorsement
is important.
Right. That's not going to cause me major problems.
Oh, I'm gratified.
But, you know, look, I have to say, given the attitude the commission has towards what campaign ads are and this consideration of 30-60-day rules now for them, you know, you make me nervous.
That comes from the statute, 30-60 days.
It's coordination.
I would just point out that the 30-60-day is, you know, many people have come to us and asked us to consider that. Personally, I wasn't considering 30 or 60 days. I'm just listening to what people have to say when they come in here.
Yeah.
And I think I know the answer to this one, but I just want to clarify it in my own mind. The court said the question that you were trying to answer with your submission was... do candidates, in fact, limit campaign-related advocacy to the 4 months surrounding elections, or does substantial election-related communication occur outside that window? If we could somehow establish that substantial, and that'll be the next question to what substantial is, that substantial election-related communication does not occur outside some window of time, would that be an appropriate window of time to write into our regulation?
I would say that if you could do a study, and not just ask the lawyers for the various parties to give you their answer, or even just us to give the answer, but you actually did an investigation, a research study, and you came up with some empirical evidence that at some point the campaign ads or a substantial number of campaign ads are not taken out. You could really develop the record. Then I would think you actually have something to move on, and you may be able to come up with a coherent rule in that effect. I don't think you're anywhere close to that.
Well, obviously we have time constraints because there are people breathing down our necks in the litigation, but assuming that we could gather that kind of empirical evidence and hire a statistician who could put it together, what would substantial mean? If we could demonstrate that 85% of election-related communications took place within whatever window that was, 90%, 95%, 75%, what do you think the court meant by substantial? And I mean that for all three panelists. I know.
Yeah, I just want to clarify one thing I said also. I would probably divide it out by groups. I don't think I would have that rule for political parties and political committees.
Is there anything in this opinion that indicates we should have a separate rule for political parties and a separate rule for 527?
Buckley and McConnell, yeah.
No, I'm talking about the Shays opinion that we
no,
are responding
to. No, but Buckley and McConnell both talk about how political parties and political committees are different animals, and they do not, you don't face the same restrictions. I also think that's true of 527s. Obviously, the commission disagrees, but I don't think you can move away from that. Buckley and McConnell say over and over again, political committees and political parties, you don't face the same problems in regulating them as you do other groups.
Well, your proposal actually has a very odd approach to that, though, because you have the most restrictions on the groups that are already most heavily regulated. That is, the political committees and the 527s are also to some degree regulated now. At least they have disclosure requirements. And you have the thinnest amount of restrictions on the corporations and labor unions that are the source of evil soft money. So I don't really understand that aspect of your proposal. But I want to go back to my original question, which is, what's substantial? Anybody want to offer an opinion?
I'd like to offer an opinion. I think that you don't need to have 100%. It seems to me that the commission has recognized de minimis standards throughout all of the regulations and the law. I mean, if you make a communication to your restricted class, you can have a de minimis number of people receive that communication. If you put out an endorsement, you can do it as long as the costs are de minimis. So no one is, I mean, I don't think the law has been interpreted as 100% law. And if you want to have a bright line, I think it's impossible. I also want to respond, however, by saying that I think that you can't just look, and I understand the court asked you to do this, at whether campaign advertising occurred during that period. What about the fact that lobbying is occurring during that period and that Congress mandated that the campaign law not interfere with the First Amendment rights of organizations to lobby? So I think, you know, just going along by Larry's standard and looking at how many campaign ads there are only gives you part of the picture of the impact that the regulation would have if you use timing alone.
I agree with what you're saying. However, looking back at what the court asked us to do, what, in your opinion, what do you think substantial in this context means? Is it 75%? Is it 80%? Is it 85%? I assume it's more than 50%.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very hard question to ask. I would say substantial could be more than 50% or, you know, 75%. But I just have a hard time with that approach because I think if you're only looking at how much campaign activity is occurring in a time period, you're kind of missing the whole picture. And that's the difficulty with just using a time standard. I think that's the reason why we ultimately decided it wasn't all that useful in terms of a framework for the regulations.
Mr. McGann, you want to take a crack at that one?
It's not for me to say what is substantial, but what I can do is offer proof, anecdotes, and actual real tangible evidence that maybe help you decide what is substantial.
Please.
Any rule is going to have some situations where someone somewhere is going to say, gee whiz, maybe that should have been covered. That's the nature of an administrative rule. You are not going to capture every possible ad that somebody may think is really a campaign ad. Can't do it. That's the name. And if you try to do that, you're going to be so overly broad that, you know, McConnell or no McConnell, you're going to have problems in court. I think everyone would agree with that. But what that being said, what I can tell you is, in my own experience, primarily my client's experience, last cycle, the first post-McCain-Feingold cycle, our independent expenditures occurred within 60 days of the general.
All of them?
We may have done some early radio, but I think it may have been all. I think September 15th was our first one for the general. So we could do a study, but we've already filed FEC reports that say what we've done. It's there. It's public. As far as campaign media, that's public at the stations. You don't need a study. Maybe you can go collect it and call it a study, but that's public information. You don't have to do research on that per se. So that's out there. And if you look at it, you're going to see the campaigns, not what campaign ads are being called by others, which is, well, in 96, the DNC ran some ads, and those are really campaign ads a year out talking about how the Republicans shut down the government. But that was really a campaign ad. That's not a campaign ad. Campaigns actually running campaign ads, party committees actually running campaign ads, occur within 60 days of the general. And you're not going to get a lot of leakage beyond that. Certainly, I don't think you get any leakage outside of 120 days unless you start begging the question of what is a campaign ad and the whole content question again, which we've kind of been around that ring now for years. But putting that aside, ads happen near the election, both campaigns and not. And I'm reading Senator McCain's comments. It is our experience as candidates that campaign ads are in fact run earlier than 120 days before an election by parties, outside groups, and by candidates themselves. Show me a campaign ad paid for by a campaign that ran outside 120 days. Has anyone offered anything in the record? Are we doing the same thing we've done the last time when the court said, gee, you don't really have things in the record to back up the rule? Isn't this I'm hearing the same kind of jive talk theory about how, well, of course there's ads. Are there? Where are they?
Actually, even under Commissioner Mason's interpretation of our ads, there are ads outside the 120-day period.
Okay. I'd be interested to see them and see if they're really campaign ads. Well, I'll take a look, and maybe I could supplement my comments if that's going to help the commission. But what is substantial to me is the data I've seen means ads come near the election. So you're safe either way. And a percentage game is difficult for me because I'm looking at what I see 100%. You're covered.
Can I?
We will have another round of questions, I assure you. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Noble, we've been talking in these rounds of questions about
really the technical details of the rule, for example, you proposed. I'd like to back away from that for a second. You know, I've only been on the commission 2 weeks, but I'd like to make sure I understand from a much higher level the public policy grounds behind the rule that your organization, the Center for Responsive Politics, is pushing. And as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, you said in your opening statement coordination goes to the heart of BCRA, and that the public policy grounds here that behind what you think we ought to do is that if a regulated entity, is it like a campaign or candidate, if they coordinate with a second organization to put out a message or perhaps even give them money, that the use of that kind of a conduit, basically, a second organization is corrupt and deceives the public. I mean, is that basically the public policy grounds behind the rule that you think we should put in place?
No.
Okay, what is it?
First of all, we didn't say anything about deceiving the public. Second of all, what this is based on is a prohibition that's been in the law for a very long time and been held and held constitutional, which is that corporate and labor contributions and contributions outside the limits embody real or apparent corruption. And Congress has a compelling governmental interest in controlling that. And that compelling governmental interest has supported the prohibitions on direct contributions and coordinated expenditures.
But the heart of that goes to the fact that you have a coordinated message going on and the second organization is basically getting around the limits.
Not just a coordinated message, but a coordinated campaign message going on.
I see. You've submitted a comment in conjunction with two other organizations, Democracy 21 and the Campaign Legal Center. All of you have signed on to it and proposed this rule. My understanding is that, in fact, your organization has received at least $900,000 from the Pew Charitable Trust. Democracy 21 has received $700,000 from the Pew Charitable Trust. Campaign Legal Center has received $2.2 million from the Pew Charitable Trust, which comes out to $3.8 million. Aren't your organizations basically acting in exactly the same way that you want us to stop? You're delivering a coordinated message on behalf of the Pew Charitable Trust in this area?
No, for many reasons. And let me start with, first of all, this message, comment was coordinated between the three organizations. And I know we get grants from the Pew Charitable Trust, and we did just get a $900,000 two-year grant from the Pew Charitable Trust. I don't know specifically the grants the others get, but I'll believe what you say on that. These comments were not discussed with, run by, or to the best of my knowledge, anybody at the Pew Charitable Trust. So in that sense, it's not as if there was a candidate. The Pew Charitable Trust takes the place of a candidate who we then go talk with about the comments. But there's actually something much more fundamental about the difference that goes to the very nature of a democracy. We are private nonprofit organizations. We are not elected government officials. We hold ourselves to certain standards. I think it's perfectly fair to you ask us about who we're funded by. I have no problem with that. I have no problem explaining our funding. But we were not elected to serve the government, to serve the people. We are not government servants. The elected officials are. They live under laws that we don't live under. And to equate private organizations with elected officials really undercuts what elected officials are supposed to be all about.
Tell me, Mr. Noble, were you present at a meeting in 2004 conducted by a Pew Charitable Trust individual named Sean Treglia in which he urged the grantees, such as yourself, to keep Pew's role in this issue a secret and in which he said, quote-unquote, that the idea for all of these grants was to create an impression that a mass movement was afoot, that everywhere they looked in academic institutions, in the business community, in religious groups, in ethnic groups, everywhere, people were talking about reform. Were you present at that meeting?
I was not present at any such meeting. I don't think any such meeting ever took place. I think what you're referring to, and maybe I'm wrong, is Mr. Trelia's comments at a conference of reporters where he discussed that's what he told people. And I can tell you from my experience at the center, and I've been there since 2000, and I know Mr. Trelia. I dealt with him when he was our program officer. And from talking to others, Mr. Trelia and no one at Pew ever told us to keep quiet their involvement. In fact, the very opposite. If you've ever worked for a nonprofit, you know that, in fact, the first thing you're supposed to do every time you appear somewhere is to say, this is funded by the Pew Charitable Trust, the Carnegie Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and we thank them for their support.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, Mr. Noble, but in fact, Mr. Treglio's a videotape of him saying this very thing.
Not to a group of grantees. It was to a reporters group.
Well, that's not my understanding of the situation.
I've seen the video. And maybe there's another one. But anyway, I know he said that. I've seen him, that he said that to a reporters group, that he told people that. It was never told to us. As I said, the exact opposite was told to us. I don't know anybody it was ever told to.
So it's just a coincidence that the three organizations that received almost $4 million from the Pew Charitable Trust are all delivering exactly the same message on the regulation here, and you want us to regulate in a way that really shouldn't extend to a group such as yourself that is basically lobbying a federal agency on behalf of a charitable organization that couldn't lobby itself.
Well, first, where do I begin with that? We're not asking the law. We're talking about campaign finance laws, and we think the campaign finance laws should apply to us as they apply to any other group. And if we get involved in any of this activity, we think that the law should apply to us exactly the same way. We're a 501c3 organization. We don't get involved in that.
Yeah, activity. But the similarity there is an exact similarity. You want and you urge us to regulate because you believe that. Full disclosure, for example, is very important. Full disclosure of expenditures is important because the public should see what possible influence there is on people who contribute money to these organizations, to candidates, when they are making rules and passing legislation. I've been to your website. There's no full disclosure there of your expenditures and your contributions, and you are engaged in very similar efforts to what elected officials do. You're lobbying government agencies such as ours to put in rules and regulations that will affect the public in the same way that elected officials put in rules and regulations that affect the public. Well, you don't seem to want the same rules to apply to you.
Well, first of all, I thank you immensely for giving us the putting us on the same level as elected members of Congress in terms of our influence. It's not true, but I thank you for doing that. No, I'm saying you, as we say throughout these rules, you treat each group differently according to what it is. And by the way, it's not similarity between what the Campaign Legal Center, Democracy 21, and CRP has said. We signed off on the same comments. We're not trying to hide that. Obviously, we talked about it. Obviously, we shared the drafts. Different people, actually, Paul Ryan wrote most of it, but different people wrote parts of it, and we agreed on it. We talked about it. The fact that all three of us signed it. Maybe if a candidate in every group that coordinated ads all signed the ads, we would have a different situation. But again, I just don't see the similarity between what a member of Congress does under a federal law that has been held constitutional and what we do under a totally different law. I'm not sure what law you think that we come under that we're violating.
Well, if you don't understand it, I'm not sure I can explain it to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Von Spakovsky. Mr. General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome to the panel. Larry, the district court decision in Shays was issued in September of 2004, and I didn't check before I came up here, but I assume the record closed some months before she issued her opinion, if memory serves. And so there was no opportunity, and certainly the court did not consider as part of the record here anything that transpired in the 2004 cycle. So here we sit in January of 2006, and something roughly 75% of the complaints we've received relating to the 2004 cycle have been either conciliated or closed, so they're on the public record. I think half a dozen of those are coordination complaints and probably all dismissals. I know this question gets asked in different forms at different times, and there's a lot of resistance to it, but I never completely understood the general objection, but I want to ask specifically here, why isn't it appropriate for the Commission to say, look, we now have the benefit of experience. We have the 2004 cycle complaints, we don't have any evidence in front of us that that 120-day window was circumvented. There are no news reports or other evidence that you or anyone else has presented to us that suggests that there was rampant circumvention going on outside of 120 days, in which case we wouldn't receive a complaint, presumably, or we'd be unlikely to. Why isn't it appropriate to rely in part on that evidence at this time in crafting a coordination rule?
Because I don't think the rule that would limit it to 120 days complies with the law. I think what it will allow, first of all, these laws are also prophylactic. I think what the rule will allow is for that coordination to go on with these campaigns, and I think you will see it. And the history of this field, you could also take, yes, the court ruled before the 2004 election, but, and I know people don't want to go back 10 years, 20 years, but the history of this field has been that when you leave open those loopholes, and the court has recognized this, Congress has recognized this, they very quickly expand. Soft money started out as a small minor issue which only one or two commissioners complained about and blew up into a very, very large industry. We saw it with the 527s. I just don't think that even if we had looked at all of those complaints, and even if we agreed with you on your investigation, though I wonder how many of them were actually investigated, I would then say that still doesn't give you the authority to say that coordinated ads with a campaign are not campaign ads and are not under the contribution limits and prohibitions. I just don't think you can do that. But I would ask, how many of those were actually investigated, those that were dismissed? My suspicion is probably the majority of them were not investigated.
Well, the question is whether there's any basis for doing so.
Well,
you talked about the history of circumvention with respect to line drawing and so on, but you certainly were here for a lot more of the history of this regulation or coordination regulations in one form or another than I was. And the history, at least as I see it, is there's not a lot going on. There are very few over 25 years, probable cause findings in this area. There are a few that went to litigation. There are a few celebrated cases that everyone likes to talk about that I understood caused a lot of angst. But what evidence has there been that the coordination regulation historically has been an area where there's been a tremendous amount of circumvention and abuse?
That's a very good question. If you go back to, I think it's about 2000, and you look at before 2000, the coordination analysis the commission was using was very different than what you're proposing today. The coordination analysis the commission was using was whether it was for the purpose of influencing election and then whether there was any discussion with the candidate. It was a very broad standard. And one could argue, turn the question back around and say, for 25 years, the commission used a very broad standard, brought a couple of cases under them. Some of them weren't celebrated. There were some that settled out. But it was generally recognized as a very, very broad standard. And it didn't seem to cause a lot of problems. And maybe that's one of the reasons there weren't a lot of cases, because, in fact, people knew, and I think the general word was, that if you talk to the candidate about an ad, you've coordinated.
Okay. Just a quick question, Mr. McGann, to give someone else an opportunity. There's been concern expressed by some of the commenters, I think Mr. Noble is one, about the so-called gap that exists, that whether you're using a 30-60-day window or a 120-day window where you've got early primaries, you essentially go dark for a period where the window, there's no longer an applicable window, and then a couple of months transpire between the primary and the general election where we're not regulating at all. What's the argument for the commission not to close that gap?
The argument is the commission needs to look at what actually happens. And if you look at what actually happens in federal elections, you'll see that the gap is not an issue because of there's very few contested primaries. You don't see an advertising wave after primaries. The vast majority, and I would say not a majority, we're talking a very high percentage of federal elections really don't get going until the general election. You can't see everything through the presidential lens. That's one election. You have all the Senate elections, you have all the House elections, and even to a certain extent you can look at state elections and realize that the gap. I almost want to turn it around and say, where is the evidence that the gap is being exploited, the so-called gap? People waiting well, we can't run this ad till the day after the primary. We're going to get a jump on the general. I don't see any evidence of that happening. Vice versa, I don't see anyone saying, oh, 121st day, let's go out with our advertising because tomorrow everything changes. I don't see evidence of that. It's pure speculation, in my view. And so the argument is, if you look at what's actually happened, which sort of gets at your original question that you asked, you realize that the gap doesn't need to be closed because the gap doesn't have any meaning as far as campaign spending, any meaningful meaning.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. General Counsel. Mr. Costa.
I have no questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you. Then I guess we'll go back to our second round, and I'll begin. Mr. Noble, I just wanted to follow up some questions in the first round, one focusing on endorsements, which one thing we have learned over the last 2 years is that our opinion in the Ford Kerr AO was not well regarded by almost anyone in that debate. And, of course, I think some commissioners believe that we were governed by the regulations that were then in place and had to come to that result in light of the regulations. And so we were looking forward to getting into a rulemaking setting where we could perhaps make some adjustments. But I want to make sure I understand your position. Do you think it would be legally permissible under the governing law, the circuit court ruling and otherwise, for the agency to fashion an exemption for endorsements as long as there was no PASO for the endorsing candidate?
Speaking only for the center, not for the other co-signers, because I have not coordinated this answer. I think you could. I want to think about whether PASO would be the standard, but I think you could coordinate. You might very well be able to come up with a exemption that would allow the actual endorsement, the types of endorsements you're talking about.
And if we drew upon, as you point out, the PASO standard, which is in the law in terms of in a lot of different places, do you think all things considered that would be a permissible approach? Speaking just for yourself and your
opinion. I want to think about the PASO standard, whether it should be a different standard, such as talking about the character, you know, the character qualification standard. But I think you can, using within that realm somewhere, I think you could carve out an exemption.
And do you feel similarly with respect to solicitations? That was another proposed exemption in the NPRM because, clearly federal candidates and office holders often raise money for outside interest groups or for party committees. Again, if we tailored it around the solicitations not having any language in them that promoted or supported the endorsing or the candidate that signed the piece. Your thoughts?
Now we're getting into a harder problem because now we're talking about the solicitation of soft money, I assume.
No, I apologize. It would just be federally permissible funds, hard dollars,
hard money.
Where, for example, you might have Nancy Pelosi signing a piece for the Democratic National Committee or something like that. Again, if we fashion the exemption that as long as that piece did not promote or support Ms. Pelosi, legally permissible?
I think you may be able to fashion a legally permissible way. I'm not saying absolutely not. No,
may be able to.
You feel good about it in general.
Hmm? You feel good about it in general. We're in the ballpark.
I think I understand what you're trying to get at, and it's something we've struggled with trying to figure out a way to do it because we understand the issues there, especially when you're talking about hard money across the board.
Sure, it won't be hard money.
Then our concerns are a lot less about it.
And, Mr. McGann, I want to make sure, in the solicitation area and in the endorsement area, would you and your clients feel comfortable if we fashioned it again on the absence of PASO?
Yes.
That would work. And Ms. McCormick, any thoughts on this? I know this is maybe a little bit, fortunately, probably for you, removed from short day-to-day activities. But
yeah, we think it would
you're
be
forward.
Fine.
Okay, great. Mr. Noble, I want to follow up, and I do appreciate that you and your colleagues did submit a very detailed proposal, and it does turn, as you indicate, on the nature of the speaker, whether they're a political committee or a 527 or anybody else. But just focusing on the political committee rule, I just want to make sure I understand it. The basic test would be that any public communication would be covered under that standard if it was made for the purpose of influencing a federal election, no matter when it aired and regardless of whether any candidate appeared in it.
It was aimed at the candidate's the jurisdiction.
Directed to the... that therefore there would be no time restriction and it wouldn't matter whether a candidate appeared in it.
Right,
the spot.
Right.
And I guess the question I have, and it's an age-old question, but it's an important one, is, in your view, what criteria would this agency appropriately draw upon in determining whether it's for the purpose of influencing election, other than, as you point to, the directed to, the targeting? I assume it's something more than that, because you indicate that was part of the test itself.
Yeah, and I know this is not going to be a satisfactory answer, but the statute talks in terms of an expenditure. It has not been further defined when it comes to a political committee. It's something that political committees have to work with all the time.
Is it any spending, basically, do you think, that's directed to these voters? I mean, is that basically where you come down?
No, I mean, look, there are certain disbursements political committees make that are not considered expenditures. You know, this is one of those metaphysical issues within the campaign
finance. But an important issue.
It's a very important issue, but I think most things political committees do are expenditures. And I think most of the ads we are talking about, which are a central concern, would be no doubt that they would be for the purpose of influencing a federal election.
So is it fair to say that, and you know, people can argue and perhaps litigate over where to draw a line, but even you would acknowledge that even for political committees where you have communications directed to voters, there's at least some subset of those communications that shouldn't be regarded as for the purpose of influencing. Is that fair?
You know, I have to say this. I'm not aware of any, but I recognize since there is a definition for the purpose of influencing, somebody might come up with one.
Because normally, would you be able to identify one? I guess is the question.
The only ones I can think of historically have been things that aren't public communications, such as certain types of administrative expenses that aren't public communication. So, you know, I'm trying to think of one right now, and I'm having trouble thinking of one, but I'm not going to foreclose it.
I also want to follow up briefly, and my time's expired, so I'll be very brief. And Mr. Noble, the firewalls have been a big issue here, and I want to make sure I understand your position. There's a proposal that if there was a firewall established that walled off the relevant decision makers, that would be a bona fide exemption that, or safe harbor that people could draw upon and basically would preclude a finding that the conduct prong had been breached. Are you comfortable with that? And if
no,
not,
I don't,
why
I,
not?
I think firewalls in most contexts, especially political contexts, don't work. They're virtually impossible to enforce. I know that some political parties have said they've used them, and I just frankly don't think that they really have a place.
When you say they don't work, I mean, Mr. McGann talked about some of the steps that are taken to basically put together silos of people, as they're sometimes referred to, and there's a lot of overhead costs in doing that, but you basically have a separate team of people who
right.
work on IEs and then another team of people who work on the rest of the party committee's activities. When you say they don't work, what are you saying that even if the silo is factually set up and is not breached, it still doesn't work?
And with all due respect to Mr. McGann, I'm not questioning anything he does. I just question whether in practice they work, whether in practice they are in fact being followed.
In other words, you question whether or not in fact they are breached, the silos in
yes.
fact are breached.
And whether or not it's something the commission would ever get at.
I'm sorry, get at in terms of...
Meaning whether you have any capability of actually ensuring yourself that the silos are in fact working, the firewalls are in fact working.
So if we had committees that submitted sworn affidavits and other sworn testimony indicating this is how they set things up and that the decision makers were in these silos, to you that still wouldn't be satisfactory?
I just don't think you should have a rule based on that, no.
Ms. McCormick.
I think we fundamentally disagree, and I think my experience has been in the labor movement that we have been using firewalls, regardless of whether the commission has approved them up until now, because it's the only possible affirmative way of avoiding being hit by a whole lot of FEC complaints filed by our opponents. I mean, we have something that we have to tell our clients that they can do in order to avoid getting a complaint that alleges that because there might have been a meeting on one day where one person from the organization met and shook hands with the candidate, that an independent expenditure has been coordinated. And the only thing that we've been able to come up with is to set up a firewall. And I think we take it very seriously. I think it benefits the commission. It not only benefits us because it gives us at least something to say instead of just having to prove a negative, we can say something affirmative. But I think it benefits the commission because we can then say to our clients, okay, not only are we not going to coordinate, but we are going to take affirmative steps to make sure that it can't happen.
Proactive steps to reduce the opportunity for coordination. Is that your
view? Yeah, because if we put the people, I mean, in my own experience, I'm not going to go into a lot with my own client, but we had teams, and I know a number of other organizations that had teams, and we thought very carefully about who needed to be on what team and how it should work, and we, as attorneys, we made sure people did what we told them they had to do, but they realized it's for the protection of the organization.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Noble, we keep asking you a whole range of different possible changes, in part because I think this is an opportunity for us to get a sense from you, and a number of people have raised the changes which they believe won't encourage circumvention of the Act, but which will make the operations of their organizations more useful. And we're trying to make sure that, you know, that we're not creating loopholes in an unexpected way, and there may be policy disagreements we have, but we'd like to sort of try and identify those things where there aren't controversies. I don't think you've addressed the one involving, maybe you have, reducing the time period in which vendors and former employees would be subject to the coordination rules to 60 days, as opposed to an election. You're opposed to, yeah. You think the election cycle time frame is appropriate.
Right.
Is that's true even in Senate races where it would be a six-year cycle?
Yeah.
What I'm struck by that.
I mean, you want to make it longer?
No. Do you think that any information somebody carried out of a campaign 4 years earlier is still useful information in any real way?
You know,
years.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. We were looking for a bright line that really made sure that within the same election cycle there was not going back and forth. Could you play around with that? Yeah, you possibly could. But I get nervous when you start playing around with that, because you start playing around with it and we end up with 30, 60 days. Yes, six-year election cycles are slightly different. But the truth of the matter is that even Senate campaigns run for 6 years now. Yes, they're low grade at the beginning in some of them, but they do.
Yeah, although I suspect if you looked 5 years out on a race, the amount of money that a Senate campaign is spending on its campaign, it's got to be incredibly small.
But they're soliciting.
But that's simply raising money. I'm not sure in terms of information about the campaign that might lead to an inference of illegal coordination 2 years, 3 years, 4 years later, whatever one might have gleaned from participating in a fundraising event would be a threat.
Again, I think a bright line is the same is the election cycle. You know, if you were to say 5 years out in a Senate campaign, would that be deadly? I don't know. I mean, it's a question of line drawing. I think you're cleaner if you say, because then you're going to get the question of, well, why not 4 years? Why not 3 years? Why not 2 years? Why not in a House campaign 1 year?
That exact problem is why we're sitting here today. I think the court said that bright lines can be drawn in the wrong place.
Right. That's right.
So we're not. That's what I'm trying to get a sense. And your sense is that it's difficult, and possibly impossible, to identify any time period in which we can safely say, short of the cycle.
Yeah, I wish we had a better record on it, frankly. I really wish that, and I know the commission is limited in its ability to do this, and I know you were under the gun, though this has been going on for, 15 months now. But, it would be interesting to have a discussion or have people in here, and I'm not talking about in a enforcement context. I'm talking about to talk about what actually goes on. My sense of it from talking to some people, and I'm not testifying about this, because, is that, yes, in fact, there varies by campaign. In fact, some early people in the campaign do very well know what's going on, and there are strategies set very early in a campaign.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I mean, my sense is we've had testimony over the last couple of days that those strategies change, and that a year later, whatever the strategy was, has and sometimes some people testified a week later, the strategy is changing because the news events around the campaign or messages are succeeding or failing, money is being raised or not. I mean,
right.
that over a much shorter time period than the cycle, the strategy changes.
Well, strategy can change a week before the campaign.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that the vendors can then a week before the campaign leave. In fact, there's a case that the FEC had years ago out of Alaska where, in fact, one of the reasons a person left the campaign was because he disagreed with the strategy and then went out and took out ads, and the commission said that they were not independent.
Right, and we're looking to try and build a time period that avoids people moving quickly out and doing that, and I was trying to get a sense if there was common ground somewhere. The second question I had is in the material you've submitted that indicated that there were 200 ads that fell outside the 120-day time period, do you have a sense of what percentage of the spending in that cycle those ads consisted of?
No, I don't.
We could. I don't know. I could look and see whether we could figure that out.
If you could, it would be helpful.
I don't know. I'm not going
to promise we can. I understand that, but to the degree that it's possible, it would help us try and.
Part of the problem is the way the reporting is done. This is not a criticism, but the way the reporting is done, the reporting is not done by ad, so we don't know specifically what money is spent on what ad.
Yeah, and my understanding is you pulled the data from National Journal, not the FEC, and so that's
exactly.
Maybe
so it may not. We thought about this, and it's not going to match up, even if we did it within time periods.
But any sort of an approximation even might be helpful as we tried to wrestle.
I'll see if we can do anything about that.
Mr. Chairman, I notice my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason.
Ms. Noble, just quickly, the character, qualifications, fitness for office, that string of things has come up several times. The Commission's discussed it before. Do you know where it came from? It's not in the statute. It's not in any court decision I'm aware of.
I did yesterday.
All right.
Because I ran across it. I know.
That'd be great. Well, I mean, if you actually know, that would be informative, even if you just let me know informally sometime. Ms. McCormick, if I understand, your organization has wanted some changes in NCLB. And you've lobbied Congress about that, and you've done some ads about it. Now, that raises two questions in my mind. Have you ever talked to any national party committees about your desire for changes in NCLB? Or would it be, I'm not trying to pin you down on, you know,
yeah.
But I mean, would that be a normal thing for you to do?
I can't answer the question because I don't have much to do with our lobbying folks, I mean, other than but... I don't think it would be surprising for us to have a conversation with a party committee about that.
So that's what I'm trying to understand. So when you're talking about a lobbying exemption, part of the problem is leaving candidates aside for a minute.
Right.
The DNC and the RNC have candidates everywhere in the country.
Right.
And so if you've gone, in this case, probably to the DNC to talk about strategy or policy on NCLB, and then you turn around and go out and run an ad anywhere in the country that names a candidate, it's either going to be a Democratic candidate, so presumably you're working with them to help, or a Republican candidate. So that, in other words, is why you feel like you need a lobbying exemption that says, okay, what are we going to consider lobbying and how are we going to draw the line between lobbying and campaigning so that you know what you can do. And similarly, I worked for a member of Congress years ago who was a conservative Republican, and the NEA was great in the sense that, you know, he was not their kind of candidate, but there was a lobbyist assigned to my, you know, that office, and they would come by to see us and so on. And I don't remember him being the target of any ads, but again, as to particular members, it wouldn't be unusual. In fact, maybe it might even be normal for your lobbyist to come and talk to virtually every member of Congress about a major issue.
Absolutely.
All right. And so then if you go out and decide to run ads naming virtually any member of Congress, you're at risk because you've already, in the normal course of your lobbying, before you even thought about running ads, you've already talked to them about the issue you're worried about.
Absolutely. I think you understand the box we're in and why we had a firewall.
And so that you came up with a firewall to try to take care of that, and it would be helpful to you for us to enunciate some standards, you know, and whether it's character qualifications, fitness for office, or whatever, you'll try to work with it so that you can avoid the box you're
in. Yeah, because we can't stop lobbying. We can't say, oh, well, we're now 120 days from a primary or 60 days. I mean, things come up. NCLB comes up. We can't pull the lobbying staff and say, don't go up there again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to see if maybe there's some other small issue that we might have agreement on. I doubt it. I see you shaking your head, Mr. Noble, and I'm quite sure that you're prepared to be disagreeable, and you will be. Are there any categories of vendors? You know, we've heard some testimony about time buyers or other vendors that don't get into content at all. They don't convey information. They're sort of administrative or ministerial vendors. Is there any category like that that you would say, yeah, we could carve out something for those guys so they wouldn't have the same set of restrictions?
I'm pleased to say I agree with you. Well, and we used to talk about this, the difference between passive and active vendors. Federal Express is a common vendor. I don't think anybody would claim just because you both use Federal Express that you have now coordinated. Yes, there are a number of what I would call passive vendors who are ministerial in what they do, administrative in what they do. Now we'll get into the definition of what's administrative and ministerial, but putting that aside, yes.
All right, well, we have an agreement in concept anyway.
Let's stop
that's
right
good.
There.
That's progress. I want to go back to, let me just give you an example, by the way, since you couldn't imagine, and your written testimony also said the same thing, the circumstances in which somebody would run an ad in the district of somebody that they had talked to, because they were already supportive, so why would you run the ad there? Well, suppose Amnesty International or a similar group, I don't know if they do any lobbying, I'd never heard of them doing it, but, you know, a group like that that's interested in those kinds of issues, is working with Senator McCain on promoting a bill to prohibit U.S. Military officials from engaging in behavior that some people might describe as torture. And suppose that there are some individuals in the state of Arizona, some federal officials in the House, that are not quite as devoted to this issue as Senator McCain is. And the organization, having discussed this issue with Senator McCain, wants to run an ad in Arizona, putting pressure on those members, the rest of the delegation, to say, please support the McCain bill to prevent torture. There's your example of why you would run an ad in somebody. And let's even say that he's up, although as I recall the last time that he was up for election, he won with some, I'm sure, gratifyingly high percentage of the vote. There's your example. But I want to go back to firewalls, which you don't seem to like very much. As I'm sure you recall, the Supreme Court has said that party committees can do both independent and coordinated expenditures. Other than by means of firewalls, what do you think the Supreme Court had in mind when they said that?
Well, I may be wrong about this, and if I'm sure somebody will correct me immediately. But in both the cases that we're talking about, which I assume is Colorado and McConnell, in Colorado they were dealing with a case where there was not yet a candidate to coordinate with.
And I always wondered why you brought that case.
They voted for it.
But
there were three candidates running in the primary when
yes.
he had that issue.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So I mean, there were three people to coordinate with, I guess
right,
is how he was.
Right. And there actually was more evidence that, but we don't need to rehash that case. And I also don't know how you mesh Colorado 1 with Colorado 2, but that's a whole other story anyway. Colorado 1, they were dealing with a specific factual situation where they said there wasn't a candidate to coordinate with. They were saying that in principle, in theory, a political party committee can do an independent expenditure. You have to understand the history of that. Going up to that point, nobody, including the lawyer for the Republican Party, thought that political parties could run independent expenditures.
But we know that they can.
So that we know they can if there is no candidate running. In McConnell, if I may,
it wasn't that there was no candidate running.
There was no nominee. There was no nominee.
There were three candidates running.
There was no candidate running yet in the general, is what it was.
Right.
Okay, there was no candidate running in the general yet. And that's what they were coordinating with. They were running the ad in the general because there was a Democratic, they were running it against the incumbent in the general.
They were running as one of the lawyers working on the case many years ago. Plus, I really liked the way it came out. There were three candidates running in the primaries, and they aired the ads during the primaries.
Right, but the ads were against the Democratic...
Mr. Worth, Senator Worth, yes.
Anyway.
Details.
I want extra time for this.
Now I forgot the question. And then in McConnell, it was dealing with a situation, if I remember correctly, where the statute said you had to make a choice.
Right.
And the court said that was unconstitutional. I don't think the court has dealt with the question yet of factually what is required for a party committee to make an independent expenditure.
But you don't contest that there is black letter law now that a party can do both at the same time.
I don't think the court's ever said they can do both at the same time.
What do you think they meant in McConnell when they said it would be unconstitutional to prohibit them from doing both at the same time?
I thought it said, I'll go back and look at it. I thought it said it would be unconstitutional to say they had to make a choice at the beginning, which one they were going to do. That they were only going to do one and not the other. And I agree with that. So you could do So you could do independent expenditures and coordinated expenditures, but it doesn't necessarily mean at the same time.
All right, so you're not doing them at the same time, but still, you would have to have some kind of the silo arrangement, wouldn't you? Because otherwise the people who were working on one, even if it wasn't at the same time, would
Possibly.
Convey the information, right? So it seems to me that the Supreme Court has implicitly endorsed this notion that a party committee can have different staffs of people working on coordinated expenditures and independent expenditures. Because if they don't have different staffs of people doing it, I don't know how they do it. People have to be working on it in order to get it done. And the question that I'm trying to get at is that if it's okay for the party committees, why isn't it okay for the NEA or for, you know, any of the other folks that have come in here to testify, as well as many folks who didn't bother?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Again, I'm not sure I accept the proposition that the court has gone as far as to say that, in fact, they can do them at the same time. But rather, at McConnell, what the court said...
What difference does it make what time they do it?
No, rather what the court said in McConnell is that you can't make them make a choice at the beginning. But putting that aside, all right, we can debate that. But putting that aside, I still don't feel comfortable with the idea of these silos. If you decide to do it, I hope that you come up with very strict rules. I hope it just doesn't rely on the affidavits of people saying that yes, I complied with the law.
Because you don't believe him when he says they have separate people doing it and they don't talk to each other.
No, but I've seen numerous examples of when people say I complied with the law, that they are being honest as to their interpretation of the law.
Well, let me just end with one final thought. You said, Mr. Noble, that you were trying to reflect reality in the way campaigns are run. Would it give you any pause at all if I were to tell you that over the course of the last 2 days, we've had testimony from numerous witnesses representing decades of experience actually running campaigns, that your proposal is completely unworkable, does not reflect the reality of the way campaigns are run, and they couldn't begin to explain it to their clients and get them to comply with it?
I've heard that before, and then they go out and explain it to their clients. No, look, I do think there's a difference between having the lawyers in here talking to you about...
They weren't all lawyers.
Okay. Well, then maybe they're slightly more credible. But no, I think there's a difference.
Easy.
I think there's a difference between having some officials in here and the commission actually doing a real inquiry into what goes on. But I've got to say, if they are saying that at the end of the primary, until 120 days, we have an early primary state, until 120 days before the general election, no campaigning.
Not what I said. What they're saying is that this three-tiered system on top of our already three-pronged system that you know, we set up with 120 days here and 60 days there, and this kind of group does this and that kind of group does that, and there are organizations that have more than one kind of group under their umbrella, is just completely unworkable in practice, and it would particularly disadvantage smaller organizations that don't have access to the kind of lawyers that have been in here testifying, but, you know, are trying to operate out there in the world.
And I am sympathetic to that, and as I said, I think in my opening statement, we did do something very controversial, which nobody else did. We actually proposed the rule, and it's probably the last time we'll do that. From now on, we're sticking to general principles, but because I know from having been here, it's hard to write the rules, and you've got an excellent staff capable of writing the rules and capable of trying to simplify them if possible and smoothing out the rough edges of it. I fully agree that we even saw problems as we were doing this, but when I was here, when we wrote regulations and even the regulations the commission passed, we were fully aware and the commission was fully aware in many instances there were some problems with the regulations and how they would be and how they all fit together. Having said that, what we were trying to do was accommodate a variety of different interests. I don't think, if in fact you think that you can't do a tiered approach, if in fact you think that this is too complicated and you're going to go for simplicity, then I think the message of the court is, if you're going to go for simplicity, it can't be under-inclusive. You can't just then go for the simplicity that allows a lot of what are in reality coordinated campaign ads to get by. And yes, lobbying needs to be protected, but also the fact that lobbying exists in a campaign ad does not mean the campaign ad is not regulated. Lobbying does not trump everything else. And so I think if you're going to try to do a rule that is much simpler than this, and I don't think this is that complicated, I have to tell you, looking at the rule, it actually breaks out pretty easily. But And it's far less complicated than a lot of the rules on the books. But if you think you can come up with a simpler rule, come up with a simpler rule. But don't buy into the argument that campaigns now, that we have some sort of parliamentary system that campaigns are announced, you know, 120 days before the election, and that's it. And, you know, prior to that, there's no campaigning going on, because that's not reality.
Well, unfortunately, the reality that everybody talks about is both that the campaign goes on nonstop and that nobody pays attention until Labor Day. So I just don't know what the reality
is. But that
is
second part, that may be right. That second part is irrelevant. Whether or not the campaigns are wisely using their money is irrelevant to whether or not it's a contribution or expenditure.
Well, I think it does bear on the issue of whether people actually are going to spend their money, because we've had testimony from people who said, you know, they don't want to waste their money and they're not going to spend it, well, at a time when it's not going to do them any good.
I agree that you're out of time, both now, or I'm out of time, and with this rulemaking. But it would be interesting. There's a lot of historical data, or at least testimony in books and such, about previous campaigns and strategies used in previous campaigns. It would be interesting someday to get some of those people in here to talk about the strategy of starting 2 years in advance.
I am way out of time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Well, Commissioner Weintraub, you asked the question I was going to ask.
That's not the first time, and it's very alarming.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll just kind of conclude by saying that, Mr. Noble, you know, you're the only person, plus the other members of your co-organizations, that are saying this is a simple rule. Everybody else who's come in here has said this is a very complex rule. And you say, well, you're sympathetic, but what clearly comes out of your testimony is that you really don't care. I mean, you all don't care that you have put forward a rule that is so complex that it will clearly chill participation of groups such as Ms. McCormick's and the other grassroots organizations out there. You cannot credibly assert to us that the grassroots volunteers who make up 95% of campaign organizations and grassroots organizations throughout the country are going to be able to understand this very complex rule that you have put out. And quite frankly, the arguments you keep making about this remind me of a quote from Abraham Lincoln, who once said after the Lincoln-Douglas debates, in talking about the arguments that Douglas was making to support his view, that Douglas's arguments were as thin as a bowl of soup that was made by boiling the shadow of a chicken that had been starved to death. And there's just no way that your rule is workable in the real world, and I haven't heard anything from you that would simplify that rule so that the vast majority of people who participate in the election process, which is not the very expensive campaign lawyers in Washington, people like the principals in your organization, they are the only ones who can really understand this, not the vast majority of people who are out in the election process. And that's all I've got. Thank you.
If I may respond just briefly, I know we're out of time, but we, with all due respect, I just absolutely disagree with you. We do care very much about democracy, about grassroots activity, about and about the average person being able to understand the rules. But the reality is, the average grassroots person is not going to come under these rules. They're not even going to be involved in them. What I'm afraid that some on the commission don't accept is that Congress passed a law barring corporate and labor activity, large contributions to candidates. That law has been held constitutional and it has to be implemented. And it's not the job of this commission to keep sitting, as Judge Carl Arcatelli said, as a super legislature, deciding that the laws Congress passed really aren't good laws and therefore we won't enforce them and therefore we'll write exemptions to them.
Mr. Noble, I don't need a lecture from you on my duties at this agency. I took an oath and I intend to enforce the law. But, you know, Mr. Lenhart, Commissioner Lenhart, his first round of questioning, gave you a hypothetical and asked you to apply your rule to it. And you were unable to give him a conclusive answer as to whether, under his hypothetical, the behavior that would have been done, whether it would be legal or not under your rule. You've got almost 30 years of experience working at this organization and in this field. You wrote this rule, and you couldn't tell us definitively whether this hypothetical would be legal under your rule or not, and everyone else is supposed to be able to understand it?
Well, I would suggest if the standard for a rule at any agency was that the people who wrote it had to be able to answer every hypothetical that came up immediately, that no rule would ever survive scrutiny.
I don't have any other questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. General Counsel.
Nothing further, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Costa. Okay. Thank you. I want to thank the three panelists very much. Appreciate you being with us today. This concludes our second and final day of hearings on the Commission's coordination communications. And I'd like to thank all six panels and all the panelists who were here with us over the last 2 days. And with that, this hearing is adjourned.